After 2 more weeks of tediously spinning the stick, I managed to produce a small ember. I then caught it in a bed of mugwort, cupped it in my hands, and blew until the mugwort burst into flames. Fire. I was in awe of this near miracle of combustion. As long as I had some sort of pithy wood to work with, I would never be without fire again. Which meant heat, cooking, and water purification in a survival situation. If the hand drill is the horse and buggy of fire making, the bow drill is the Model T, the next step up the evolutionary ladder. To make the bow, I peeled off thin strands of yucca leaf and twined them together. I then tied the yucca cord to either end of a thick, curved oak branch. To make the other 3 necessary pieces of the drill, I carved a rectangular fireboard out of cedar, a pointed spindle intended to spin in a notch in the fireboard to generate friction, and a small square block to hold on top of the spindle to keep it steady. Finally, in a somewhat disgusting, yet undeniably practical bit of survivalism, I did something I learned in tracker school. I stuck a finger in my ear, fished out a little wax, and rubbed it on top of the spindle to lessen the friction against the handhold. It is a renewable resource, after all. To generate an ember, I wrapped the string of the bow around the spindle and pulled back and forth to make it spin in the notch of the fireboard. When the yucca cordage had spent hours making snapped in seconds, I replaced it with paracord. The faster speed and more continuous motion generated an ember much quicker than the hand drill did. I realize if you're listening, it's hard to imagine exactly what it looked like. So if you go to neilstrauss.com/bowdrill, B-O-W-D-R-I-L-L, I'll post a picture of it there for you. Meanwhile, I was frustrated by the slow progress of my St. Kitts citizenship application. Maxwell was now claiming he had to wait for the Prime Minister to return from vacation, but at least the delay gave me time to get comfortable with my first skill in the Sacred Order. Shelter Mondays. My initial Monday shelter session lasted from noon until sundown. To begin the day, I wandered the hills near my house with garbage bags, collecting dead grass, leaves, twigs, and branches. Then I returned to my backyard and stuck 2 Y-shaped branches in the ground, about 18 inches apart, so that the tops met in the center to form 2 adjacent Ys. I nestled one end of a thick 8-foot-long branch into the Ys and propped the other end up on a log. This would be the ridgepole for my shelter. I leaned sticks against the ridgepole on both sides so that it began to look like a small tent. Then I covered this ribbing with branches to create a crude latticework. Finally, I dumped all the debris I'd collected on top. Supposedly, 3.5 feet of debris will keep a person warm above 30 degrees Fahrenheit. 4.5 is good to 0 degrees, and 6 feet of dry, dead debris will keep someone alive at 40 below zero, an experience I hope never to have. I shoved as much remaining debris inside the shelter as I could. Then I crawled in, rolled around to smash it flat, and filled the space with debris again. After repeating this process a few more times, I built a small door frame out of leftover sticks and leaves, then used one of the debris-filled garbage bags to seal the opening. According to Brown, a good way to keep warm in an emergency is to stuff your clothing with fistfuls of debris. Fact. Some homeless people do the same thing, but with crumpled pages of newspaper. That night, I put on long underwear, jeans, and a hooded sweatshirt, and waited patiently as Katie tried to stop me. There are microscopic bugs living in the leaves. You're basically sleeping on a bed of bugs. Don't do it. It's disgusting. I'll fumigate it with a smoldering branch, I replied. You should wear a surgeon's mask, too, so the bugs and spiders don't go into your nose and mouth. She noticed I was laughing, then thrust her lower lip forward. You think I'm kidding, but I'm not. I'm sure whatever they're eating isn't as good as your blood. After promising to come back inside for a dust mask if I needed one, I crawled into the debris hut. I scrunched into the leaves, pulled the garbage bag door shut, and prepared for bed. After an hour, I was cold, itchy, and fantasizing about my warm, clean indoor bed with a girlfriend in it. But instead of sniveling, I put on shoes, grabbed a flashlight and a garbage bag, and searched for more debris to insulate the hut. I'd gathered most of the dead leaves near my house already, so I filled my bag with yard trimmings from a neighbor's recycling bin, dumped it over gaps in the hut, and crawled back inside, exhausted. But before I could fall asleep, I heard something scratching outside. The more I tried to ignore it, the louder it seemed to get, until I was wide awake, worried that at any moment a rat would burst through the debris and scamper across my face. Maybe I needed that surgeon's mask, after all. If I'd been in a real survival situation, I suppose I would have been excited by the prospect of breakfast in bed. But since I wasn't, I rustled the debris and shook the hut. But the scratching didn't stop. All I succeeded in doing was shaking loose some of my precious insulation. The city had its own natural world, and in that moment, it seemed much dirtier and more aggressive than the natural world of the forest. Eventually, I drifted into a deep sleep that lasted until sunrise. It was amazing to think I'd just spent so much money on a house in St. Kitts, yet was able to build this little studio apartment for nothing. All I needed now was an exterminator. Fortunately, trapping small game was on Friday's agenda. Water Tuesdays. Before tracker school, I never knew that cutting a wild grapevine would produce water, or that chewing thistle stalk, after removing the thorns, of course, would temporarily mitigate thirst, or that the small amount of liquid in cactuses is generally too bitter to drink, or that if I were ever stranded at sea, I could drink fish spinal fluid, the liquid around fish eyes, and turtle blood, or that I shouldn't eat meat when dehydrated, because breaking down food leads to further water loss, or that sucking on a pebble with my mouth closed would conserve water and lessen the feeling of thirst. Most of all, I didn't know that it was possible to make water out of basically nothing. So for my first Liquid Tuesday, I built a solar still. In the morning, I dug a hole roughly 2 feet deep and placed a cup in the middle. Then I grabbed green leaves and grass and scattered the vegetation in the hole around the cup. Supposedly, if there's no foliage, the solar still will still work if you pee in the hole. And if stranded at sea, you can place the cup in a larger container, partially filled with salt water. I covered the hole with a clear garbage bag, secured the plastic in place by burying the edges in dirt, and placed a stone in the center so that the garbage bag dipped inward over the cup. Incredibly, when I checked the still that night, water had condensed on the inside of the plastic wrap and dripped into the cup. The following Tuesday, I attempted a similar process, but this time, I wrapped a clear garbage bag around a leafy tree branch. 2 days later, the bag contained much cleaner, better-tasting water than the solar still had produced, though only half the amount. I thought of all the movies I'd seen, with parched men crawling through the desert, begging for water. If only they'd known how to make a solar still, then things would have been different. They'd have been begging for garbage bags instead. The Wednesday Survivalist Dinner Party. On Wednesdays, to make my catastrophe training a little less lonely, I invited friends over for a dinner party. Each week, I attempted a different method of primitive cooking as Katie fretted in the background, worried I'd catch the shrubbery, the house, or one of her hair extensions on fire. Fortunately, thanks to my cert training, I had a Class A extinguisher next to my fire pit, and I knew how to use it. I'd also bought 4 containers of thermogel. Supposedly, if I sprayed the chemical on the outside of my house during a wildfire or a cooking party gone wrong, it would be safe from the flames. For my first dinner, I tried a rock boil, which consisted of heating rocks in the fire, then dropping them in a pot of water to make goat stew. I decided not to tell the guests where the goat came from. The following week, I tried coal cooking, in which I raked a bed of coals away from the flames and simply dropped raw steak on top. Next, I tried a rock grill, which was an improvement on the above procedure, because cooking steak on top of hot rocks instead of coals resulted in less ash on the meat. Then I tried spit cooking, in which I thrust 2 Y-sticks in the ground on either side of the fire, then impaled a chicken on a 3rd stick that rested on top. For the first time, I noticed neighbors observing me from the 3rd-floor window. I hoped they wouldn't call the fire department. I was most likely violating several, if not all, of the Los Angeles fire codes. The following week, I tried a steam pit. I dug a hole in the ground, lined it with rocks, and built a fire on top. When the fire burned down to coals, I covered them with 6 inches of grass and leaves. Then I lowered a chicken on top, added another layer of vegetation, and sealed everything airtight with a wooden board, a tarp, and a thick layer of dirt. For this particular dinner party, I left a note in my neighbor's mailbox inviting them. I figured it was the polite thing to do, given that I dug up an area that may have been their lawn to make the pit. And finally, I tried a clay bake, in which I encased a stuffed chicken in an airtight dome of clay, built a log cabin fire around it, and let it cook for 90 minutes before cracking it open. Tried is the key word here, because initially, every one of these simple cooking methods was a complete disaster. Perhaps this shouldn't have been a surprise, since I can't even make popcorn in the microwave without burning it. The meal typically began at 9 p.m., with hungry guests receiving whatever edible scraps I could gather from the undercooked wreckage of my cooking experiment, while Katie called Domino's to order pizza. But gradually, after enough of my irritated friends pitched in to help, I became more comfortable around the fire than I'd ever been in the kitchen. The result was some of the most tender, flavorful meals I'd cooked in my life. Tracking Thursdays. At Brown's suggestion, I built a tracking box in my backyard. It was basically a 4x8-foot sandbox. On Thursdays, I made prints in the sand and studied the tracks. Sometimes I ran, other times I moved in a slow stalk I'd learned at tracker school, and after a few weeks, I'd clap my hands or bend down to pick up keys to see how it affected the print. Though the goal of these weekly practice sessions was to embody Kurt Saxon's definition of a survivalist, a self-reliant person who trusts himself and his abilities more than he trusts the establishment, I began to notice a related and unexpected side effect. I was developing the sense of centeredness I'd noticed in some of the students at tracker school. When I went out with friends, I didn't need to dress up. I didn't need to be at the coolest club in town. I didn't need to drink. I didn't need to talk to anyone. Wherever I went, I brought myself, and that was enough. I was turning into either Clint Eastwood in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or the Unabomber. I wasn't sure which yet, especially after I started hunting game in my backyard. Primitive Hunting Fridays. A British naturalist I'd met at tracker school named Lee had told me that, in his opinion, I needed to master 3 essential qualities and 3 essential skills for wilderness survival. The 3 qualities were nature awareness, physical fitness, and self-mastery. The 3 skills were proficiency in the hand drill, the debris hut, and the throwing stick. Since I'd already been working on the first 2 skills, mastering the throwing stick became Friday's goal. The steps to making and using a throwing stick are as follows. 1. Find a stick. 2. Throw it. In a survival situation, bringing down a deer isn't necessarily a good thing because it's too much meat for one person. As Tom Brown's son put it, the best refrigerator is on the hoof. So the throwing stick is for nailing rabbits, raccoons, squirrels, and the neighbor's cat. The sidearm throw is a Zen art and should be done by instinct as soon as the animal comes into view. Hesitating for even a fraction of a second usually means missing by a wide margin. On my first Friday, I found the ideal stick on the side of the road near my house. It was heavy, straight, wrist thick, and about 2.5 feet long. That night, I drove to a parking lot nearby and practiced throwing it sidearm and overhead at different targets. Eventually, I could strike almost any stationary object from 20 yards away, though when I saw my first moving target, a raccoon, I didn't have the heart to brain it, especially since, if I did, I'd have to eat it, or serve it to my friends at the next dinner party. I was truly regressing as a human being. Other Fridays, I made snares and deadfall traps and planted them in my yard, hoping to catch the rat that had disturbed my sleep in the debris hut. Though the contraptions were inventive, the rolling snare, for example, was designed to send victims hurtling into the air on the end of a sapling, I was never able to catch the rodent or any of its friends, despite adding baits like cheese, peanut butter, and Betty. Saturday edible plant walks. Originally, I try to forage for food by myself. I'd choose an edible plant to learn about each week, then set off in search of it with a Peterson field guide tucked under my arm. But on my first hike, when I was unable to find more than one dandelion, I'd hoped to gather hundreds to make dandelion wine in my bathroom, I decided to seek outside help. A Google search led me to the School of Self-Reliance, run by Christopher Nyerges, who organized weekly edible plant walks in parks and forests around Los Angeles. I met him and 10 other students the following Saturday afternoon at the Arroyo Seco Trailhead in Altadena. He wore a blue button-down over a white polo shirt and a straw-brimmed hat with a purple bandana wrapped around it. Over one shoulder was a backpack with the tip of a bow drill sticking out. He looked equal parts golfer, zoologist, and Indiana Jones. Nyer just led us in a mile-long loop, stopping every now and then to feed us a flower, leaf, or stem. He was an unlikely guide because he didn't appear to enjoy teaching and seemed irritated by questions. He did, however, enjoy having an audience to impress. We ate the little yellow flowers of mustard plants, the sweet, juicy celery-like buds that lay inside the stalk of young bull thistle, the succulent cucumber-like roots cut from stalks of cattail, and the delicious jicama-like fruit of the yucca flower. It seemed like at least a third of the plants we passed were edible. Then Nyer just stopped in front of what looked like anorexic parsley. I'd seen the plant often that afternoon and wondered if it was edible. "What's this?" he asked. Mark Forti, a filmmaker and a regular on the walks, responded, "California parsley surprise." "If you eat this," Nyer just said flatly, "you'll be dead in half an hour. It's hemlock." It was amazing how ubiquitous the plant was. If you wanted to kill someone, all you'd have to do is take them on an edible plant walk, then feed them a stalk of parsley. Some 15 minutes later, their limbs would go numb, followed by unconsciousness and death. Instead of showing us how to recognize each plant and discussing their many culinary and medicinal uses, Nyer just enjoyed lording over us with his knowledge. "See that lily?" he'd say. "Pretty, right?" After we all agreed, he'd rub it on our faces. "If you eat that lily, you die. Most lilies will make your throat swell and suffocate you." A few minutes later, he was in front of poison oak. "Just standing downwind of this will get you infected," he cautioned. "But I can eat it." Then he ripped off a leaf in his bare hands and put it in his mouth. In that moment, he joined the ranks of Tom Brown and Mad Dog in my pantheon of survivalist superheroes. "How did you do that?" I asked, incredulous. "After a while, you develop an immunity to it." A few steps later, he pointed out a raggedy green plant that stood inches off the ground. "You could have a party with that," he said. The plant, he went on to explain, was Jimson weed, which can be made into a tea that causes psychedelic hallucinations. The too large a dose is fatal. Every plant we encountered, it seemed, could nourish us, kill us, or get us high. It was like Mother Nature's own ghetto. After 2 months of survival cross-training and walks with Nyerges, not only did I finally feel proficient with all four elements of the sacred order, shelter, water, fire, food, but I felt more healthy, alive, and comfortable in my skin than I ever had. I'd spent most of my life avoiding long walks, manual labor, and kneeling in the dirt. If it weren't for this training, I never would have realized that these were exactly the things my body was designed to do. Lesson 44. Survival uses for music critics. My house had completely transformed. My yard was no longer a place to get a suntan. Instead, it was filled with a fire pit, a tracking box, a debris hut, shovels, stacks of wood, piles of debris, and newly planted vegetables and fruit tree saplings. My basement was no longer just for storage. With Mad Dog's Museum of Early American Tools book as my guide, I'd started building a rudimentary workshop. My closet was no longer for fashion. Cargo pants, wool hunting jackets, ghillie suits, and tactical belts swung from the hangers. The floor was littered with boxes containing flashlights, rechargeable batteries, bullets, gun cleaning kits, night vision goggles, and half a dozen folding and fixed blade knives, along with sharpening rods and stones. In my garage, there was barely enough room for my car between the Rokon and the boxes of emergency supplies. And the rear seat of my Durango was no longer a place for passengers, but a shelf for my bug-out bag, first aid kit, and cert uniform. Even the walls of my house were no longer intact. With my early American tools, I'd built a hidden panel, behind which I'd stashed my pistol, rifle, shotgun, and metal detector-proof knives. In the backyard, I created a trap door with a hidden crawl space, which was big enough to hide not just supplies, but, if necessary, me. I'd clearly gone off the deep end, and I had no intention of stopping. Not when I was so close to slaying the demon of just in case. Just in case of nuclear attack, I bought potassium iodate tablets online to lessen the effects of radiation poisoning. Just in case of chemical attack, I'd gotten a friend on the survivalist boards to send me duodote injection pens to stop the symptoms. Just in case of an armed attack, especially while trying to escape on the Rokon, I used a connection of Mad Dog's to purchase an Enforcer concealable bulletproof vest from U.S. Armor. Just in case Katie or I became ill when the shit hit the fan, I'd driven to Mexico to stockpile antibiotics, though some survivalists prefer to get them from feed stores instead. Just in case I needed to evacuate from L.A. by water, I'd contacted the American Sailing Association to take their basic keelboat sailing 101 class. Just in case of just in case, I learned to tie basic knots, grind grain, bake bread, catch fish, sew clothing, smoke meat, make preserves, and can food. All my life, I'd never had to do anything practical. If something in my house or apartment didn't work, I called a repairman or landlord. If my car broke down, I called AAA. If I was hungry, I ordered takeout. If I needed something affordable, I bought it online. If it wasn't affordable, I used credit. My tools were the telephone and the internet, which instantly summoned the services of other people. But as the world of survivalism opened up, I began to realize that I'd been rendered completely helpless by convenience. Maybe the instructors at tracker school had a point. Life was more exciting now that I was learning to handle just about anything that came my way without having to depend on anyone or anything. 2 decades after puberty, I was finally becoming a man. As my obsession with figuring out how to do everything myself intensified, I drove to a self-sufficient community called the Commonweal Garden outside San Francisco that was part of what's called the permaculture movement. I wanted to learn how to design a completely sustainable life from scratch. On the roof of one of the houses there, for example, there was a rainwater catchment, which fed water into a shower below. The runoff from the shower filled a pond, which supported ducks. The ducks ate bugs off strawberries in the garden, which were served for breakfast. The leftover breakfast scraps were dropped into a bin of worms, which were used to feed fish that maintained the balance in the pond, and the worms' waste was used to fertilize the strawberries. It was a perfect, closed, interdependent system, a microcosm of planet Earth. I stuck around for 3 days, trying to learn all I could from the people who ran it. And I discovered, much to my distress, that if I wanted to be a more long-term-minded survivalist, rather than killing Betty for meat, I should have learned how to breed and milk her. "It's too bad that you killed a girl goat, because she could have had babies," Katie had told me at the time. "Guy goats can't do that. They're guy goats with sperm everywhere." So as soon as I returned home, I went to the website goatfinder.com and began researching the possibility of raising a female goat, much to Katie's delight. Good thing I didn't kill a whale. In college, I'd seen a documentary called The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On, about a Japanese director trying to find out what happened to 2 soldiers from his regiment who disappeared while serving in New Guinea during World War II. Eventually, he tracks down their commanding officers, and after much badgering, They admit that the platoon was trapped without food, and at least one of the missing soldiers was killed and eaten, so the higher-ranking officers could stay alive. Watching the film triggered an old fear I used to have as a child, ever since being forced to watch movies like The Day After in school, and learning about historical aberrations like the Donner Party. I wondered, if I were part of a group that was stuck somewhere with no food, would I be the eater or the eaten? And I was forced to admit every time, sadly, that I would be one of the eaten. As a student, and then as a writer, I possessed no skills that would be useful to a starving group, unless, of course, they needed a music critic. But now, everything had changed. My training was making me eligible to lead that group. And as leader, I would decree that nobody gets eaten, because there's enough lamb's quarter and cattail and dandelion out there to keep us all alive. And if there isn't, because, say, the earth is scorched, well, if there's a tasty-looking music critic in the group, I can show them exactly how to butcher, skin, and gut him. What was wrong with me? I was turning into Mad Dog. I thought of all the post-apocalyptic movies I'd seen. The Omega Man, Things to Come, Mad Max, 28 Days Later, Night of the Comet, The Matrix, 12 Monkeys, Waterworld, The Day After Tomorrow, The Last Man on Earth, Day of the Dead, A Boy and His Dog, I Am Legend, Doomsday, and on and on and on. And what did almost every one of them have in common? They took place primarily in a city. And the few that didn't were set in a desert wasteland with only a little shrubbery to gnaw on, or, in one notorious case, in a water wasteland. There wasn't a lamb's quarter or cattail plant in sight, let alone enough debris to make a shelter, or sticks to make a hand drill, or natural resources to sustain a permaculture community. I may have thought I was ready to survive World War III, but there was one major flaw in my thinking. People like Tom Brown, the primitivists, the naturalists, and the permaculturists lived by certain rules. One of those rules was that anything that grew in nature was good, and anything made by modern man was bad. But that wasn't reality. In a real-life shit-hits-the-fan scenario, it would be hard to avoid the detritus of society. A sharpened bicycle spoke will probably make a better spear than a stick. A length of electrical wire will make stronger cordage than a yucca leaf. And foam padding, ripped from the seats of an abandoned truck, will provide warmer insulation than debris. Wilderness survival was good for the forest. But what about the urban jungle? Lesson 45. Secrets of Escaped Felons. Kelly Allwood didn't say a word as he handcuffed my hands behind my back, opened the trunk of a rental car, and ordered me to get inside. With his shaven head, which looked like it could break bottles, his glassy brown eyes, which revealed no emotion whatsoever, and the .32-caliber pistol hanging from a chain around his neck, he didn't seem like the kind of person to cross. As he shut the trunk over my head, the blue sky of Oklahoma City disappeared, replaced by claustrophobic darkness and new car smell. Instantly, panic set in. I took a deep breath and tried to remember what I'd learned. I curled my right leg as far up my body as it would go, and dipped my cuffed hands down until I could reach my sock. Inside, I'd stashed the straight half of a bobby pin, which I'd modified by making a perpendicular bend a quarter inch from the top. I removed the pin, stuck the bent end into the inner edge of the handcuff keyhole, and twisted the bobby pin down against the lever inside until I felt it give way. As I twisted my wrist against the metal, I heard a fast series of clicks, the sound of freedom as the two ends of the cuff disengaged. I released my hands, then made a discovery few people who haven't been stuffed inside a trunk know. Most new cars have a release handle on the inside of the boot that conveniently glows in the dark. I pulled on the handle and emerged into the light. 39 seconds, Allwood said as I climbed out of the trunk. Not bad. I couldn't believe classes like this even existed. In the last 48 hours, I learned to hotwire a car, pick locks, conceal my identity, and escape from handcuffs, flexicuffs, duct tape, rope, and nearly every other type of restraint. The course was Urban Escape and Evasion, which offered the type of instruction I'd been looking for to balance my wilderness knowledge. The objective of the class was to learn to survive in a city as a fugitive. Most of the students were soldiers and contractors who'd either been in Iraq or were about to go, and wanted to know how to safely get back to the green zone if trapped behind enemy lines. The class was run by a company called On Point Tactical. Like most survival schools, its roots led straight to Tom Brown. Its founder, Kevin Reeve, had been the director of Tracker School for 7 years before setting off on his own to train Navy SEALs, Special Forces units, SWAT teams, parajumpers, Marines, snipers, and even SEER instructors. As a bounty hunter, his partner, Allwood, had worked with the FBI and Secret Service to help capture criminals on the most wanted list. For our next exercise, we walked inside to a shooting range behind the classroom where an obstacle course had been set up. Allwood handcuffed me again, adding leg chains to my feet. I then ran as fast as I could through the course, ducking under and climbing over chairs and benches, simulating a prison escape. By shortening my stride and putting extra spring into each step, I found it easy to sprint across the room. I knew those childhood jump-the-bum games would come in handy. "You look like you've done this before," Reeve joked. Though I was hopelessly out of my element when it came to wilderness survival, I actually wasn't too incompetent in this class. Because I'd lived in cities all my life, I had at least some semblance of street smarts. "We're 9 meals away from chaos in this country," Reeve lectured afterward, explaining that after just 3 days without food, people would be rioting in the streets. With gas and corn prices so high, the events of the last 6 months have made it much more likely that you'll be needing urban escape and evasion skills in this lifetime. To prove his point, Reeve told us of gangs of armed looters that ransacked neighborhood after neighborhood in New Orleans during Katrina. One of the police officers there told me they shot on sight 3 people out past curfew, he added. For some reason, I was more disturbed by the idea of killer cops than marauding gangs. Maybe it was because of the recurring nightmares I used to have as a teenager of being mistaken for someone else and taken to jail. In the dreams, I'd be so petrified during the ride to prison that I usually woke up in a cold sweat before I ever made it there. Since then, I'd come to realize it wasn't actually jail I was scared of in those dreams, but the loss of freedom that it represented. As the sun set, we drove to an abandoned junkyard, where Reeve let us practice throwing chips of ceramic insulation from spark plugs to shatter car windows. He showed us how to use generic keys known as jigglers to open automobile doors, and how to start cars by sticking a screwdriver in the ignition switch and turning it with a wrench. As I popped open the trunk on a Dodge with my new set of jigglers, I thought, this is the coolest class I've ever taken in my life. If I'd had these skills in school, I would have been playing much more fun games than jump the bum, like hotwire the teacher's car or break out of the juvenile detention home. Over a barbecue dinner later that night, Reeve asked why I'd signed up for the course. "I think things have changed for my generation," I told him. "We were born with a silver spoon in our mouths, but now it's being removed, and most of us never learned how to take care of ourselves. So I've spent the last 2 years trying to get the skills and documents I need to prepare for an uncertain future." I'd never actually verbalized it before. I'd just been reacting and scrambling as the pressure ratcheted up around me. Reeve looked at Allwood silently as I spoke. For a moment, I worried that I'd been too candid. Then he smiled broadly. "You're talking to the right people. That's what we've been thinking. Kelly has caches all over this country and in Europe." On the first day of class, Reeve had taught us about caches, hiding places where food, equipment, and other survival supplies can be stored away from home, whether buried in the ground or stashed in a bus station locker. The thing with caches is that you have to be able to survive if one is compromised, Allwood explained. So each one has to contain everything you need. Gun, ammo, food, water. You'll need lots of ammo, Reeve added, because that will be the currency of the future. I pulled out my survival to-do list and added, make caches. I'd noticed that the way people prepare for the end of the world as we know it has a lot to do with their view of human nature. If you're a Flyzine like Allwood and Reeve, and you think that without the rules of society to restrain them, people will become violent and selfish, then you build a secret retreat, stockpile guns, and start a militia. If you're a humanist, like the permaculturists, and believe people are essentially compassionate, then you'll create a commune, invite everyone, and try to work in harmony together. Just as I had my triangle of life, and Tom Brown had his sacred order, Allwood and Reeve had their own list of essentials. Water, food, defense, energy, retreat, medical, and network. By this point, I already had at least the basics of most items on their list covered, with one glaring exception. I didn't have a network. I'd found no groups where I felt like I belonged. The billionaires were out of my league. The PTs were too paranoid about Big Brother. The survivalists were too extreme about guns and religion. The primitivists were too opposed to technology and modern culture. And the growing tide of 2012 doomsdayers seemed more interested in trying to prove it than doing anything about it. And unless you're Robert Neville in I Am Legend, and even he died at the end, the best way to survive when the shit hits the fan will be to have a well-organized team with members cross-trained in every necessary skill. I'd recently read a book called Patriots by an infamous survival blogger named James Wesley Rawls. A how-to book disguised as fiction, Patriots tells of a future in which inflation has made the dollar worthless, leading to social, economic, and government collapse. Fortunately, a group of 8 friends has been training and stockpiling supplies for years, just in case. So they hole up in a compound in rural Idaho, and thanks to their military organization, survival skills, Christian values, and weapons expertise, successfully fend off looters, gangs, and even the United Nations. The lengths they go to in order to accomplish this are not just extreme, they're inspirational. They build a 900-gallon diesel storage tank, a solar pump and 3,500-gallon water cistern, a 57-foot-high wooden tower for a wind generator, 7 camouflaged foxholes to ambush intruders, and bulletproof steel-plated doors and window shutters. And that's just a small fraction of their preparations. They even add an extra fuel tank to their vehicles, which inspired me to look into doing the same. I needed to start putting together a similar, if slightly smaller scale, network. At the very least, I needed a few allies I could trust. A pack of wolves, after all, is a lot more powerful and dangerous than a lone wolf. Even Kevin Mason, the CERT fireman, had strategically made friends in his neighborhood. Who did I have? No one. Now you do, Reeve replied when I shared my thoughts. You can always come to us. Although Reeve lived in New Jersey and would be difficult to get to when the shit hit the fan, I appreciated his offer. It made me feel less alone. At least I now had someone with more experience than Spencer whom I could call for advice. But you can't come to us tomorrow, Allwood said, a cruel smile forming. Tomorrow was our final exam, because we'll be hunting you in the streets. Lesson 46, A Crossdresser's Guide to Combat. It was 9 a.m. on Sunday morning, and I was in the back seat of a Range Rover, handcuffed again. This time, it was to another student. His name was Michael, and he was preparing to work in Iraq as a truck driver for Halliburton. He was trying to earn money, he said, to open a laundromat. Everyone has to wash their clothes, he explained, the dollar signs practically glinting in his eyes. Reeve had driven us 10 minutes outside downtown Oklahoma City, confiscated our bags, and left us handcuffed in the SUV in a parking lot in a desolate part of town. If we were caught anywhere in the city by Reeve and his cohorts, most of them bounty hunters and military trainers, we'd be put in restraints, thrown in the back seat of their car, and dropped off miles away to start all over again. Luckily, I'd internalized the first lesson of urban survival, planning. I'd spent the previous night locating supplies, hiding them in caches, and finding collaborators in the city. To make sure my bobby pin pick wasn't confiscated, I made a thin slit in the seam of my shirt collar and stashed it inside. I pulled it out and undid my handcuffs, then Michael's. Beneath the Range Rover floor mat was an envelope containing the first of several tasks we need to execute in downtown Oklahoma City to prove we learned to successfully navigate a dangerous urban environment. Our first assignment was to meet an agent wearing a black hat in the Bass Pro Shop in an area known as Bricktown and use persuasion engineering to get her to reveal our next mission. Bricktown was a long walk away, especially since we'd get caught by bounty hunters if we took the main streets. Nearby, however, there was an Enterprise rent-a-car office. Perhaps someone there would give us a ride. The only customer inside was a young, muscular man in a large, sleeveless basketball jersey. He was at least 6 inches taller than me and 3 times as thick. His face was crisscrossed with scars, so I asked him for a ride. Our friends dropped us off here as a joke, and we have to make it back to Bricktown. Is there any way we could get a lift? You got any guns or drugs on you? He asked. That wasn't exactly the response I'd expected. No, definitely not, we reassured him. I'll give you a ride then, he grunted, but I gotta warn you, if I'm pulled over by the police, I'm not gonna be nice to them. I didn't know what he meant exactly, but it was scary as fuck. In that moment, I realized this wasn't a game. This was a real city, and this was real life. Yet we followed him outside to a black Chevy Tahoe and climbed inside anyway. This, I realized as he drove us into town, was how people got killed. Evidently, in my mind, the law of conservation of energy had overruled the principles of common sense. As he drove into town, he handed me his card. Underneath his name were the words, Credit Doctor. If you ever need your credit repaired, I can do it overnight for the right price, he informed me. He, too, was an urban survivalist of sorts, with his own method of beating the system. He dropped us off in an alley in Bricktown, where I'd cached a bag of disguises the night before. In a lecture on urban camouflage, Reeve and Allwood had taught us there was a certain category of people in cities called invisible men. If the city is a network of veins, invisible men are the white blood cells. They work to keep it clean. They're the janitors, with bundles of keys on their belt loops. The alarm servicemen, with clipboards and work orders. The UPS men hidden behind piles of boxes. And the construction workers with hard hats, safety vests, and tool belts. In these disguises, Reeve and Allwood said, we could walk unnoticed into almost any event. However, since Allwood and Reeve had taught us these disguises, I knew they'd be looking for invisible men. But what they wouldn't be looking for was an invisible woman. I slid under the back porch of a Hooters restaurant and found my bag of disguises. Miraculously, it was still intact in a small ditch in the rear of the crawl space where I'd cached it the night before. I grabbed the bag, climbed out, and entered a small corridor of shops above while Michael waited in the alley. Inside, I found a public restroom and began my transformation. First, I shaved my mustache and goatee in the bathroom mirror. Then I stepped into the stall and put on a flowery yellow cardigan I'd bought at Walmart after having seen a nondescript woman wearing a similar top. I removed my cargo pants and replaced them with women's black dress slacks, then swapped my sneakers for yellow flats. Next, I pulled out a purse I'd stuffed with the rest of my disguise. Hat, wig, sunglasses, clip-on earrings, and makeup Katie had recommended. Face powder, mascara, and lipstick. I left the stall to put on the hat and wig. Gazing at my reflection in the bathroom mirror, I realized, to my disappointment, that I didn't even make a good transvestite, let alone a passable woman. I hoped Katie's makeup tips would help. I powdered my face, which helped conceal the faint outline of my freshly shaven beard. But as I was pulling out the mascara, the bathroom door swung open, and a thick-necked college student with a crew cut and a striped button-down shirt stumbled in. His face was patchy and red, as if he'd been drinking. He looked at me and slurred, "What the fuck are you doing?" "I'm doing a class exercise," I blurted, hoping it would sound normal enough to calm him down. Then again, I was in a men's room in Oklahoma, dressed like a woman. "What the fuck are you?" I wasn't so sure I understood the question, but I tried to answer anyway. I'm being chased by bounty hunters, and I need to dress like a woman so they don't recognize me. He glared at me and knitted his brow. I tried to clarify. "It's for a course I'm taking on urban evasion." In response, he opened the bathroom door and yelled into the corridor, "Hey, Brohim, get a look at this." Seconds later, his Brohim walked into the bathroom. He was bigger than his friend and just as drunk. "What do we have here?" he asked as soon as he saw me. At this point, I was sure I was going to get my ass kicked. With the two of them blocking the exit, I needed to put my survival skills to use immediately. Unfortunately, there were no locks to pick and no cars to hotwire. And instead of my Springfield XD, I was carrying a purse. I'd learned from Mad Dog that force respects greater force. So I ripped my hat and wig off in one motion, mustered as much toughness as I could, and told them coolly and firmly, "I'm in the fucking Marines. We're doing a drill in the city. Now back the fuck out before I get the rest of my battalion." The thick-necked guy who started it all stared for a moment at my shaven head and then said, sheepishly, "I guess you are in the Marines." Thank God I hadn't attached the clip-on earrings yet. I made a mental note to add another skill to my survival to-do list, hand-to-hand combat. I couldn't be a runner all my life. The only reason they were leaving was that they thought I was a fighter. I was reminded of something Tom Brown had said at tracker school when teaching us to hunt. A fleeing animal is a vulnerable animal. After they backed out of the bathroom, I quickly changed into my jeans and tennis shoes again. Then I put on a military green cap I'd bought, glasses, and a flannel shirt. With my facial hair gone, I hoped I'd be difficult enough to recognize. I'd learned my lesson. Cross-dressing is not an urban survival tactic. It's an urban suicide tactic. When I returned to the alley, my urban escape team was waiting for me. Michael had been joined by four locals I'd recruited by posting a bulletin on MySpace the previous night, asking for volunteers in Oklahoma City for a top-secret mission. Evidently, there's not much to do in Oklahoma City on a Sunday afternoon. Because the instructors had divided us into pairs, I hoped to escape their notice by moving in a larger group. Sticking to alleys, parks, and industrial areas, we made our way to the Bass Pro Shop and safely carried out the first few missions. But then I made the mistake of leaving the group to grab another cache, which included a set of lockpicking tools. As Reeve had taught us, once you learn lockpicking, the world is your oyster. I found the cache behind a pile of sandbags lying along the banks of the city's canals. But as I made my way back to the group, I noticed a bounty hunter on a bridge above. He hadn't spotted me yet, but he would soon. As he descended a staircase leading straight to me, I looked around. There didn't appear to be anywhere to hide or run, except for a door on the side of the bridge. I tried the knob. It was locked. I grabbed my lockpicking tools, found a pick with a flat underside, stuck it inside the lock, and raked it against the pins. There were four of them. I selected a thin pick with an S-shaped end, known as a snake, and stuck it into the lock. At the bottom of the lock, I inserted a tension wrench. As I raked the snake along the pins, I pressed gently downward on the handle of the tension wrench. After a couple minutes, the wrench began to turn. I pushed slightly harder on the wrench, and with a click, the door was open. This class was better than my entire college education. I needed to remember this wasn't a game. This was reality, and it could have consequences. After emerging 15 minutes later, I rejoined my team and completed the remaining assignments, which mostly involved finding and photographing survival locations and items in the city, a water source, food source, daytime hiding location, safe place to sleep at night, easy-to-steal car, and an item that could be turned into a stabbing weapon. This could just as easily have been a Fagin-like class for future career criminals. But like most governments, police forces, and armies, by calling ourselves the good guys, we had full permission to do any bad things we wanted. That is, until other people, who thought they were the good guys, felt otherwise. While looking for water, available from several fountains, and food, available from edible plants and public ponds stocked with fish, I accidentally found several caches in the bushes made by homeless people. One contained a frying pan, the other a plastic bag with blankets inside. Between the cracks of the city, there was another world. And in that world, I learned, it was possible to live with no name and no money. I'd never thought of the homeless as survivalists before. After completing our assignments, we reported back to Kevin. "How'd you get everything done so quickly without getting noticed?" he asked suspiciously. Though I was worried he'd accuse me of cheating, I told him the truth. I'd recruited a scout and camouflage team on MySpace. "I saw those guys," he replied, "but I had no idea who they were." That goes down as one of the all-time great class stories. I was relieved. Unlike wilderness survival, urban survival had no restrictions. Whatever worked was permissible, and that's why it appealed to me. After all, living like our primitive ancestors doesn't necessarily mean using sticks and stones. It means using every resource available and any means possible. When I talked to Spencer after returning from Gunsight, we'd concluded that there were only two scenarios to plan for, bugging in and bugging out. Thanks to Reeve and Allwood, I was finally ready to aggregate the skills I'd learned and conduct a trial run of the apocalypse to make sure I was fully prepared. That is, after I called the Krav Maga Center in Los Angeles and signed up for street fighting lessons. I wasn't going to get caught defenseless in a bathroom dressed as a woman again. Lesson 47. Exam number 1. Shelter in place. Day 1. 12:39 a.m. My intern Tomas calls and announces, "L.A. has shut down. Lights out, water off, gas off." His timing couldn't be worse. I have a towel wrapped around my waist, and I'm about to step into the shower. But I must follow the rules. And the first rule is that Tomas will call me at a random time during the week to begin the 3-day test, simulating a citywide emergency shutdown. So evidently, I won't be showering for a while. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, the outside world won't exist until Tomas comes by in 3 days and tells me the crisis is over. The goal of the test is not just to take care of myself during that time without any utilities, but to make sure I have the necessary logistics and supplies to hole up for an entire month or longer, both here and in St. Kitts, in the event of a major disaster. I grab the flashlight near my bed, walk to the fuse box, and shut off all the circuits. Then I find the master valve for the water line and turn that off. Next, I turn off my BlackBerry and unplug my landline. Finally, I grab one of my new survival tools, the rescue wrench, a combination seatbelt cutter, window punch, gas shutoff, and pry tool, and turn off the gas. In the dark silence that ensues, I feel calm and look forward to a deep sleep. Because I am prepared, or at least think I am, I don't fear the isolation. All I fear right now are the fish, which I've been practicing catching, gutting, and primitively cooking, spoiling in the freezer and stinking up the house. I write on my troubleshooting list, "No fish." 9:30 a.m. I bring my laptop into bed to write. I work for half an hour with no TV, no ringing phone, no internet, no email with a link to some YouTube video of a hamster licking its balls to distract me. I've never had a more productive 30 minutes. This little experiment might just be the best thing that's ever happened to me. At least, that's what I think, until I discover the first flaw in my 3-day test. I credit this discovery to my bladder after 8 hours of sleep. The problem is that I can't relieve myself in the toilets, because they might not have a last flush left. I can't go in my backyard, because it's small, I don't want to attract vermin, and well, I just don't want to pee in my backyard. And I can't use a bush outside, because there's a busy road in front of my house, and I'll definitely be spotted urinating alongside it. As I'm kneeling above my kitchen sink and unzipping my pants, worried that without water to wash it down the drain, my urine will reek up the house along with a dead fish, I remember a 72-hour survival kit I bought after 9/11. It remains untouched in my garage. I zip up, find the duffel bag, brush off the dust, and open the top flap to discover a stack of water pouches, and below them, a gift from heaven. The Jungle John. It contains a cardboard base, a cardboard seat, and 5 biodegradable garbage bags. I assemble